Chris Barrett is with the Department of Agriculture, Resource, and Managerial Economics at Cornell University in New York. His new book is called Food Aid After 50 Years, Recasting Its Role. Barrett examines the basics of food aid, the U.S. food aid system, and food aid management around the world. Barrett looks at the food aid sector with an eye toward how it might need to be changed. Todd Gleason recently interviewed Barrett, first asking him to give an overview of his work.
Well, the book that we wrote is on food aid globally. It's not just the U.S. programs, but the United States accounts for 60% of global food aid. So effectively, we need to focus on the U.S. And the fundamental change that happened in the system is we went from an old arrangement where the government provided price supports for farmers and collected large surpluses, primarily of grain, but also non-fat dry milk powder and such, as a result of being the buyer of last resort, and then would ship those surpluses overseas outside of the commercial market as food aid. But as those price support programs unwound, the government maintained food aid programs that were still run essentially in the same way as they had been when it was based off of government surpluses. So now the government goes out and issues an invitation for bids. And so large agribusinesses offer to supply commodity, shipping lines offer to supply the freight services, and the government then purchases these commodities and freight services to ship abroad. And the result of that is supposed to be humanitarian assistance. But the problem is when you no longer hold the grain in a stockpile someplace and ship it away immediately when you get a need, but instead you go through an elaborate procurement process, that the delays become quite great. And as a result, we're seeing that the average time from the request for food aid to port delivery is 5 months now for emergency shipments. And that's just too long to wait. So there's a big human cost to this in terms of time spent waiting when people are really in desperate straits already. Plus, there's a very big expense involved in shipping. 40 to 60% of the U.S. food aid budget goes to freight and administrative expenses now. The actual cost of the food is increasingly a less than half of the program. So we've got a system right now that's spending a lot of money on the things that aren't actually helping hungry people around the world, and the response is relatively slow so that we're not helping people when they really need help. So that part can be improved. The system does help people, but it can be improved. There's a lot of room for improvement. The other side of this is that many people still believe that the food aid system is helping farmers because it used to be a part of a system that did help farmers because of price supports. But the food aid procurement system really doesn't benefit farmers. That's an important myth that pervades all the discussions in Washington. You think about this in basic terms. The value of the commodities purchased by U.S. food aid programs is about $500 million in an almost $1 trillion food economy in the United States. I mean, that's a drop in the ocean. So the analogy I like to use is I have five kids and live in a small rural town. If you believe that when my wife and I show up to buy groceries, the grocer increases the prices, then you can also believe that when the U.S. goes in to buy food aid, U.S. prices for farm products goes up, because the economic impact of my family's purchases in our town is actually greater than the impact of U.S. government purchases for food aid on the U.S. food economy. You plainly don't believe the grocer marks up the prices to us, so why would you believe prices go up for farmers from food aid? It just doesn't happen. So we have this myth that the U.S. farmer is benefiting directly from food aid programs. That myth is exploited by the small group of organizations that really do profit from food aid programs, especially the shippers. Again, almost half of the food aid budget goes to freight costs, and a small degree, some of the larger agribusiness concerns that sell into the system. And they too make money in part because of the shipping restrictions. There's an obscure bit of law called the Cargo Preference Act that came in alongside the food aid legislation 50 years ago in the summer of 1954. And cargo preference requires that 75% of U.S. food aid shipments go on U.S.-flagged carriers. There are only 13 such lines registered to provide these services to the United States government, and they make on average 60 to 80% more than the open market cost of the same service provided by a non-U.S.-flagged carrier who could carry grain from New Orleans to Mombasa just as easily. And so that process not only generates big profits for the small number of shipping lines involved, but because we have this restriction, the government has to match commodity offers with freight offers, and you often can't get freight offers in the place the commodity is available for the lowest cost. So you often have to overpay for the commodity as well. And some of the larger agribusiness concerns are taking advantage of this process. They're very clever, and they make on average about 8%, 10% more than the open market price for the same commodity at the same place and time, largely because of the distortions in this bidding system. In my experience, U.S. farmers care about food aid not because they're foolish enough to think that they make money off of it, but because they care deeply about food and they care about people, and they don't like the idea that there are hungry people in the world. But American farmers are also incredibly efficient, and the idea of the waste in this system and the unnecessary delays in this system, I find when explained to farmers, offends them. And they want to see these sorts of reforms. They want to see a system that works in meeting the basic needs for hungry people around the world. And as soon as they understand how it really works, that they're not getting economic benefits out of this, and that the restrictions we've got restrict the ability of the system to meet the needs of the hungry, they want to see this thing cleaned up, just like Canadian farmers have.
And how is it that you suggest they do that?
Well, the Bush administration last year proposed a simple refinement that we take one quarter, only one quarter of the U.S. emergency food aid budget, and rather than requiring procurement of commodity and shipping services in the United States, that where appropriate, the U.S. government's authorized to buy food closer to where you need to distribute it. Because it's often the case that there's a surplus right next door to a place where you've got a food emergency. So last summer, there was a crisis in West Africa. People saw images of dying kids in Niger. But right next door, there were food surpluses. But the U.S. government was restricted from being able to buy food locally and just move it right in. So we had to pay a lot more and wait a lot longer to be able to attend to the pressing needs simply because of this restriction. The Bush administration proposed relaxing that, and the Congress refused to go along with it. It's likely that it will be proposed again week after next, when the next fiscal Euro 7 budget is proposed. And it will be interesting to see how that debate unfolds in the Congress. That's one reform. A second reform is to roll back the Cargo Preference Act, to stop spending so much money on freight costs and driving up also the procurement costs for the grain and the milk powder we ship abroad by relaxing this restriction that 75% of it has to go to U.S. flag carriers. We have a Department of Defense program to support the merchant marine. We don't need to be piggybacking expenses on food aid for that as well. The hungry shouldn't be paying for maintaining a merchant marine force for us.
Thanks for joining us, Chris. Chris Barrett of Cornell University. He authored a book along with Daniel Maxwell called Food Aid After 50 Years, Recasting Its Role. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.